Open loops. Do, do. Open loops. Open loops. Open loops. Open loops. You must listen to the open loops, a theme park for absurd beliefs and systems of integration between the mind and the creative spirit. Open loops.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Open Loops with Greg Bornstein, Conversations That Bend, a late night talk show for your unconscious mind. That's right. What is an open loop? It's an unconscious provocation. It's a cliffhanger. It's the dot, dot, dot of the incomplete sentence. It's that thing that makes you wonder, what's next? What are they going to say? What's the answer to that? This show is all about chasing those moments, going down rabbit holes, expanding your mind. You see, my goal is to challenge your existing belief system by sharing, along with many featured guests, radically unique ideas to stimulate your unconscious mind. And that way, you'll step into the highest version of yourself. I'm Greg Bornstein. I'm a looper. I'm a cultural hypnotist, a transformational entertainer, and really a curator of the countercultural, strange, paranormal, and all things that make you go, huh? Yes, hypnosis being one of my favorite topics that falls into this realm. And today's episode is a continuation of our Reality Without Trance Deep Hypnosis Dialogue series with somebody that makes my brain go, huh? All the time. Master hypnotist James Tripp. He is the creator of the Hypnosis Without Trance model, the first person that really publicly came out and said, you don't need to go into a deep state of hypnosis to get all these things happening. Hands sticking to walls, negative hallucinations, you forgetting your name. You don't need trance. Trance is not it's not a thing that's required. Hypnosis is about something else. That something else is really the topic of the second part of this series. We start by going into the three principles, which for if you're not aware, it's been around for a while. It got very popular maybe about 5 or 6 years ago in terms of coaches everywhere jumping on this. It's kind of like mindfulness, and not at the same time. It's this idea that all your emotions are just, and experiences of reality, your emotions and experiences of reality are just thoughts. If you're depressed, it's because you're thinking depressing thoughts. And the world is made up of thought. And once you sit into the principles of mind and thought, you realize that everything that's negative or positive going on in your daily life is really just a projection of your thoughts. And your thoughts are all there is. And once you keep realizing that, well, you don't need to go to a therapist anymore because you're at one with the notion that your thoughts create your reality. I try to explain it again later in the episode and I butcher it there too. Just go with that. It's like mindfulness, thoughts create reality, all that stuff. We start there because I know James went down that direction of pursuing it with change work for a while, and I wanted his honest take on it. But then we get back into some of the fringier aspects of hypnosis. Can you create a hypno-assassin? What about these gypsy, quote-unquote, hypnotists that meet you on the street and then say a couple words and make you freeze in place out of your conscious control? And we even pivot into challenge hypnosis. If someone says, can you hypnotize me, James? Can you do it? if the person's a skeptic. Ending the conversation with a little bit of my favorite, and went into this in a previous episode, my favorite debate, is hypnosis just placebo? There's a whole lot of other stuff in there too about the line between influence, hypnosis, what actually causes people to be in what some would describe as a mind-controlled state. This is why we call part two coercion or co-creation, because it clarifies the notions of what's happening. The phrase that he uses a lot, and you'll hear it in this episode, is levers, pulling psychological levers to evoke emotions and different effects, different states, different hypnosis phenomenon. It's a really, I love this part. It gets into some fun hypnosis topics, the stuff I love talking about. So here it is, part two, with master hypnotist James Tripp.
I did have a moment. It was a bit of an existential crisis when I came across the three principles, because I bought my first exposure to it, I guess, formally, was Jamie Smart's book, Clarity. Mm. And what I loved about that book was that it was deliberately, he was like, read this and you will transform. And that's kind of what a lot of three principles guys talk about. It is, they kind of do like the, yeah, this is like a, I mean, I would call it quote unquote hypnosis. You're gonna, as the text is designed to open things up in your heart, in your mind, in your soul, in your being. But Jamie, I mean, he was in one of the great NLP and hypnosis trainers. And once I read that book, I was like, oh gosh, maybe all this change work stuff, all the NLP hypnosis, all the rituals, all this transactional theory, all this stuff doesn't matter because it's all just thought. And the three principles are stronger than anything else. And then I saw you get into it and I was like, okay, I hope James Tripp goes through this and doesn't just drop hypnosis and go all three principles. And you didn't. So here's my question for you. Why not? Why is three principles not that? And I don't even know how to explain it simpler for my listeners, except it's like a mindfulness framework that ultimately, if you understand that your experience is just thought, then you understand that in a deep way over and over, I'm really reducing it here, then you know what? You don't even need to see a change practitioner because you've realized it's thought, and that awareness is enough to get you clear. When I heard that, I was like, okay, I guess I should throw away all the hypnosis books and just become a three principles coach. So yeah, why is it not that simple?
Well, because the 3P people, they fall for a trap. And by the way, I want to say I really value the three principles stuff. I kind of went into it pretty fully, immersed myself in that reality tunnel. I paid a lot of attention to good 3P coaches. I modeled good 3P coaches. I analyzed them in different ways. And it's good, and it has a lot of value, and I like it a lot. And I've known Jamie for a long time, since before his three principles days, and he always used to talk about going all in with the principles. And I remember saying to him, Jamie, I really do value this stuff. I've got a lot from it, but I'm just not an all-in kind of a guy.
Mm.
And one of the reasons is this. 3P is just another reality tunnel. And it gets you what it gets you, and it doesn't get you what it doesn't get you. It's the same as anything. You know, NLP, it's another reality tunnel. It gets you what it gets you. It doesn't get you what it doesn't get you. And there is no reason why you cannot spend time in both of those and more. Now, I've been involved in martial arts for years, and I train in different martial arts, lots of different martial arts, Silat, Bagua Zhang, Tai Chi Chuan, Sistema that everyone laughs at online now, and I understand why, but there's brilliant stuff inside of it. Boxing, Muay Thai, all sorts of things interest me. And I don't, now a lot of people in martial arts, they think their system is the complete system. So I'm currently studying SEALAP with a guy called Stephen Benitez, who's brilliant, and it's very, very comprehensive. He insists, this is all you need. I'm like, okay, Steve, whatever's, you know, there's still plenty of stuff outside of that. What I find through cross-training in different martial arts is I learn something from all of them, and it influences me and who I am being and how I am being and what choices I have. Same with different systems of philosophy, of self-development, of influence, of whatever. I just treat them as separate systems, and I let them inform me, but I don't make the mistake that the three principles do, because what three principles says is everything you feel is just your thinking, apart from what we feel, which is to do with deeper principles than that, right? You know, everything is like your mind makes up your reality, apart from the reality of the three principles, which is the truth.
Right.
It's not the truth. It's just another reality tunnel that has incredible utility and works brilliantly until it does not.
Yeah.
And there are places where it just doesn't. I'll tell you a quick story, because I nearly went all in with the three principles. Nearly.
Yeah.
Right. I nearly did, because I got coaching from a 3P perspective, and I got a lot of personal value from it. I started using more and more of it with my clients, and then more and more and more and more. And I was thinking, this is just super easy. This is getting great results.
Yes.
With everybody. And then I had this guy rock up. He hired me for 6 months coaching. And I was like, yeah. And I'm thinking, okay, I'm going to take him through this whole 3P thing. And then once he'd sort of come in for the coaching, he told me that he had done Jamie Smart's clarity practitioner training, and that he had done Michael Neal's training. I can't think which one it was. But he'd spent a lot of time in Michael Neal and a lot of time with Jamie Smart, and it hadn't fixed his problems.
Mm.
And I was like, oh, shit. I was going to do that stuff.
Yeah.
So what do I do now? I thought, okay. And I said, so how come you come to me then? He said, well, you know, I just like the way you communicate things and it resonates more with me. I thought, okay, fair enough. So this guy was absolutely racked with, he was very, very reactive. His threat response systems would go off like crazy. He would drop into rages if he was pushed in any way. And I coached him for 6 months. And honestly, I felt like we got nowhere after 6 months. He slayed Jamie and slayed Michael, and he slayed me as well. And I really felt that we got nowhere.
Yeah.
And I felt kind of like a bit bummed out at the end of it, thinking, oh, didn't really help this guy. And I didn't stick purely to 3P because I knew I had to think outside the box, but I just really didn't get anywhere. Then that was a few years ago, and it was before I went off traveling around the world, which was quite a few years back now. And then I got hold of Bessel van der Kolk's book, The Body Keeps the Score. Have you ever read that?
I haven't, but I've heard people recommend. I think you've recommended it before. I haven't picked it up, but I've heard.
I got a lot
things.
Of value from it. But my friend Jürgen hates it, but I like to.
Jürgen Rasmussen.
Yeah, he hates it, but he's got his kind of ideological reasons for hating it, I think.
Right, well. Right.
But I read it, and I was just kind of reading it, and there was so much to this guy that Bessel van der Kolk was describing, which I could immediately see in this client that I'd had. And it put a whole different framework around this guy and what might be going on for him. So when I got back from traveling around the world, I got back in contact with him. I said, look, we did 6 months work together. And honestly, I didn't really feel like we made anything like the difference that I would like to have made. And he's like, well, no, I didn't really make the difference that I wanted to make either. I said, look, do you want to do a session or two? Because I've got some different thoughts about what might be going on, what might be possible for you. I said, well, we'll do them free of charge. And he said, yeah, sure. And he came in, and I did two sessions with him and got, and do you know what I did?
What?
I did stuff based in things that I'd learned years before. I went back to the kind of David Grove stuff, great David Grove trauma reprocessing stuff, clean language based stuff. I did sessions with him with that approach and got really big shifts with him. Really big shifts. So I think when it comes to change work stuff, if you start looking at how anxiety works in people, if you start looking at, there's two pathways for anxiety. There's like a bottom-up pathway and a top-down pathway. Now, what 3P is really good for is that top-down pathway, stuff that has its origins in the prefrontal cortex. 3P stuff works really well for that kind of, they talk about insecurity, you know, you're insecure because you're feeling insecure thoughts. That's true, but that's only one pathway. Now, the truth of the matter is, it's like when somebody has a bottom-up based sort of anxiety, there's usually top-down elements that feed back in as well. So 3P is still going to help with that, but it's not necessarily going to remedy the issue out now. Talking of Jürgen, because Jürgen's approach is heavily influenced by 3P, his psychological illusions model that he does with hypnosis. He was telling me about a three principles trainer who shall go unnamed, who was really, you know, really quite big on the 3P scene and hired him to help with an issue that Jürgen cleared using regression work.
Right.
Right. So, which actually makes a lot of sense if you understand the top down and the bottom up pathways, because there's certain stuff that 3P is going to leave untouched. It may help you not throw fuel on the fire, but it's not going to get to resolving the underpinnings of it. So I still think there's incredible value in it. I don't think it's necessarily the be all and end all. There are other approaches to self-development and change which offer different possibilities.
Do you ever think you're going to find a, I know it's talked about a lot as a myth, the silver bullet kind of thing. As an explorer, are you looking for that kind of framework that is going to rule them all out?
No, because it doesn't exist.
How do you know that for sure?
I know that for sure because, again, look at martial arts, combat sports, right? You never get, apart from possibly Floyd Mayweather, you never get,
yeah.
Right? You don't get someone who's utterly unbeatable in all contexts, right? You just don't get it. There is no one, there's no such thing as the ultimate fighter, someone who is unbeatable in all contexts. You might get someone who's more highly adaptive to a wider range of contexts, but they're not unbeatable across all contexts. There's no such thing as unbeatable across all contexts. Now, we live, but the reason for this is because the world we live in is complex. And I don't mean complex as in complicated, the way people use it in an everyday sense. I'm talking about the way that systems dynamics use the term complexity. So there's enough complexity, enough variability that we cannot rely on the same fixed context all the time. And context is king. It's hugely king. So there's enough complexity and there's enough richness. So if you take somebody who's like, if you take the ultimate UFC, mixed martial arts, whoever is the top of the heap at any one time has got a particular combination of attributes, skills, expertise, understandings, all of these sorts of things. And that might keep them the top of the heap, but you get somebody else who comes in with a different mix who beats them out at some point. And then someone else with a different mix will beat them out at some point. So the truth of the matter is, like, in order to be, so the reason I say it won't happen, or at least I believe it won't happen, is because to believe that there's one simple solution that would fit every single situation is to deny the reality of complexity out there in the world. Now, my YouTube channel is called Chaos Wave.
Yeah.
And the reason being is like you cannot control the wave. You can only learn to meet the wave with higher levels of adaptedness. It doesn't matter. You find the best surfer on the planet, they'll wipe out from time to time. There's no magic bullet, right? It may be that if they rode exactly the same wave again, though it's not possible because every wave is different, right? Every wave is different and every ride is different. And that's the truth of it working with clients. Or whatever, creating in life, working with clients, creating in life. Now, and I think that's kind of what keeps the whole thing. Like some people might go, oh man, that's so such a bummer, you know. There's no solution. There's no ultimate solution. Yeah. But actually, you know, like I think ultimate solution is death anyway. It's just the end. Like if you've got everything figured out in the world, everything figured out in life, now what?
Mm. Like
there's just nothing left. Why would you do anything? It's just nothing left to achieve, nowhere left to go. Now, so like I think to say, you know, is there a one ultimate solution for X? It's like saying, is there one ultimate solution for life? And if somebody, right, like you go, well, no, there can't be one ultimate solution for life. And you say, why? Because life's just too fucking big. It's too rich. It's too huge. But so is individual transformation. So is, you know, so is simple communication. So is influence. This is one of the reasons why. And some people jump on me for this. I get jumped on for this for more than anything. It's when I say hypnosis is not mind control. Hmm. And it never will be. And it never can be. All you can become is more and more and more adept at influencing the complex systems that are other human beings across an array of circumstances. But you can never control a human being any more than a top boxer can control the outcome of a boxing match. Right, they can only influence it through their skills and how they engage and all of that kind of thing. And the better they are, the stronger their influence. But they never reach the level of complete control. It doesn't exist. It's a myth.
So have you ever, I don't know, I'm trying to remember your video, if you ever did one on a hypno assassin. If someone were to come to you and be like, hey, what's going on with people that are quote unquote mind controlled slaves, if that ever actually was a thing, do you have an answer for that?
This can come up from time to time because I saw something recently with somebody claiming that they've been mind controlled by a number of hypnotists to nefarious ends.
Yeah.
Now, I don't want to question that person's, I don't want to, what's the word, invalidate their experience. So I never said anything on that thread because I knew it was a sensitive topic for the person involved. So I didn't say anything. And I don't doubt that they believe that that's what happened.
Hmm.
But, you know, I don't think it's, I think it's probably less to do with the skills of the hypnotist and more to do with the psychological makeup of that person. I.e., some people are more influenceable than others. Some people are more ready to be influenced and go along with things. And I'm not taking on a conscious level. I'm not talking about like a conscious thing. It can be outside of consciousness. So I don't think, I think of course we can influence people. Of course people can be influenced. If you pick a charismatic cult leader who, you know, pick a David Koresh or a Jim Jones or a Charles Manson, clearly those people were people that knew a thing or two, probably unconsciously, about getting people to follow them. But that doesn't mean that everybody that met Charles Manson would have joined the Manson family.
Yeah.
Right? However, like you could go, oh, look, he controlled these people. He certainly influenced those people. But it's not like, you know, it's not like, you know, there's that thing like in, you've seen Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah.
Right? You know, there's that scene in Silence of the Lambs where, Hannibal Lecter gets Miggs to bite off his tongue because he's insulted Clarice Starling and he's in the next cell and he whispers something and talks him into biting his tongue off.
Right.
Right. You know, people think that that's like, oh my God, you know, are there people out there that can make people do stuff like that? Of course, there are some people who are better at influencing than others. And there are some people who are more prone to influence than others. And even that isn't a simple dynamic. It might be that person A is influential with, you know, an A type influences a C type well, but doesn't influence a B type well. if you see what I mean. So there's a lot of variability in the mix.
This is, it's so interesting that you ride that line between explaining away the magic, but still saying that the magic's possible. Because I'm now sitting here thinking about, I don't even know where this came from, this myth of gypsy hypnotists, people in Eastern European countries that go into stores. I mean, I don't know, someone used this as a marketing clip years ago, but go in and like quickly say something to the bank teller, and then they hand over all the money and all that stuff. And it's, oh yeah, this stuff is spells. It's magical. It's, You've talked to a lot of hypnotists. Is there some underground clan of people who are doing these nefarious acts? What's going on there?
Yeah, there are. I mean, like I've met them on, I met them on Venice Boardwalk. You know,
yeah. Are they hypnotists? Would you say skilled influencers?
Yeah, skilled influencers. There was a crew on Venice Boardwalk who were out doing some, like making a spectacle of nothing. And they got hundreds of dollars of people around them. They didn't even do anything. It was all, it was a masterclass. I'm telling you, there's a group of, and I've seen this act, I've seen this skit. So this obviously exists. This is a thing. I've seen a lot of different crews running this particular thing.
Yeah.
Where they build the audience up to believing they're going to see something, but they milk them for tons of cash. They voluntarily hand over. And like, if you look at it, it is, particularly this group I saw, it's a masterclass of pulling psychological levers. You know, and one of the people I was with, who, they handed over a bunch of money. And I'm like, haha. And afterwards he said, and I was kind of amused by this, my friend who handed over the money, he said, I was just rewarding them because they did such a good job of psychologically manipulating everyone. And I'm like, I don't think that's it. I think that's your backwards rationalization for the fact that they pulled your levers like a good'un and you handed over big wads of cash.
Yes.
Right. Now, here's the thing. Is that hypnosis? And I think it's as much hypnosis as anything. Like, all to me, what hypnosis is, that the practice of hypnosis, the craft of hypnosis, is good hypnotists, really good, really adaptive hypnotists. And I'm not talking about people that run stock processes. I'm talking about really good hypnotists are simply really good influencers. And they will use all manner of psychological levers to move somebody from person A to person B. This is what I do when I'm working. This is why I do mostly conversational hypnosis, because I'm pulling psychological levers and I'm running strategies, gambits, all sorts of things to move somebody's mind from place A to place B. So these people out there, they are getting a lot of people to part with a lot of money. And they've got that act really well honed in that context. And as I say, I've seen other people running the same, I don't know what you'd call it, gambit, the same, what is it the con artists do? What do they call it?
Oh, gosh.
I don't know, but it's like
ruse,
ruse or whatever. But like it was so beautifully crafted. Now, what they do is they've made high craft out of extracting money out of passersby on Venice Boardwalk. They have made a high craft of it, and they are incredibly good at doing it. You take any kind of confidence trickster, they make a high craft of separating their mark from their money, right? I had a client a few years ago who'd been taken by a boiler room operation. You know, they phoned him up, convinced him there was a investment opportunity that was not to be missed. And they took him for everything, literally lost his home, everything. But the worst thing for this guy was, is afterwards, it was his self-image. It was the damage to his self-image. He came out of it, and I've seen this a few times because I've worked with a few people who have been kind of traumatized at the hands of others, malicious other human beings. And the biggest impact, negative impact of it, is on self-image. Like, how stupid was I? How could I have been so stupid? You know? And like I said to this guy, at the time, Andy Murray was the Wimbledon champion. I said, "Did you play tennis?" He said, "A little bit." I said, "If you played Andy Murray, do you think you'd win?" He said, "No." I said, "Would you beat yourself up afterwards and say, oh, what an awful person I am because I didn't beat Andy Murray. He'd say, no. He said, no. I said, how come? He said, because Andy Murray's a world champion tennis player and my tennis is terrible. I said, right. The person on the other end of that phone, that's the Andy Murray of the boiler room world. They have probably conned hundreds upon hundreds, if not thousands of people out of their money, and they're good at doing it. I said, how many expert con artists have you met in your life before now? None. I said, so you have no experience dealing with a situation like this, and you're meeting someone who has it honed to a high craft. Is there any reason why you wouldn't get taken there? It seems to me it's the same as if you played tennis with Andy Murray. He's like, oh, right. Now, of course, if I play tennis with Andy Murray, Andy Murray's going to beat me because he's that much better at tennis. But that doesn't make Andy Murray somebody who could beat everybody. Right?
Yeah.
Do you see what I mean? And like, so there's still no control. It's still not a control situation. It's a situation of high craft, high levels of skill, high levels of adaptability. It's the same in any field. You pick an incredible basketball player and they're going to play some great plays, but they're not going to be all conquering. You pick, you know, scam artists. You pick, you know, street performers who might know how to extract money well from people. And I don't doubt that there are people who probably can get people in shops to hand over cash.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. Imagine that if the best person in the world are getting people, you know, shop clerks to hand over cash, if the best person in the world could do it 1 in 20 times, they'd still do well because they just rock up at 20 different stores a day and get their takings from one a day. But what you wouldn't see is the 19 times they didn't do it. And if you saw them on CCTV doing it once and somebody said, look at this, right? You might think that they could do it 20 out of 20 times, but they're doing it 1 in 20 times.
Yeah, this is, it does raise the question that I was going to ask you about getting people into, or getting people to experience the phenomena. This makes me, I'm curious what your views are on this, because when I started looking into hypnosis, I think the thing that interests me most, and it still does, is that you can make people supposedly hallucinate. You could get to deep trance, and then once you, I know you talk about getting up the belief ladder, but once you've done enough stuff to, you know, like, okay, they forgot the name, they've done amnesia, all the stuff with catalepsy, being stuck to the floor, all that stuff, then you can leverage that into doing either negative hallucinations or positive hallucinations. And when I got into hypnosis, I was on a fervent search to find the trainer that was like, here's how you get every single person to be able to experience all these things. No one could. I mean, there's some people out there that claim that Justin Trance, who's someone I've trained under, he at the very least claims, which I love, is that he's a showman. He says, I do challenge hypnosis. Someone comes up to me and says they can't be hypnotized. I will do it. I will prove it to them. So that to me is, yeah, it's a little bravado. It's also part of his brand. I'm sort of curious. Let's go with that. If somebody came up to you right now, was James, I don't believe that you could have me experience something that I would call hypnosis. Could you do it?
So is the could you do it your question or their question?
I guess it's my question. In the same way, because to me it would be, okay, you made me experience my hand getting stuck to the table, therefore I was hypnotized. Sometimes people really need that thing. Right. Do you believe you're able to, take on a challenger?
I'll admit that I don't. I outframe them every time. Always outframe them. Now, I'm going to give one example of this. I'm aware there's a time and a place to do things. I had a guy at a workshop in London years ago. It was not a workshop I put on. It was a workshop that somebody else had put on, a guy called Nathan Thomas, who used to have a blog called Keys to
Mind. Yeah.
Yeah, Nathan's long out of the hypnosis game now, though I did speak to him recently. But he put this event on in London and had a load of guest trainers and had me come along. And I'd been talking about hypnosis, and I had a guy go, wait, yeah, but could you do that to me? Could you do that to me? Now, instantly, to me, that's a red flag. Now, I've got this thing about red flags and green flags.
Yes.
So I don't want to buy someone's red flag. So I can't even remember what I said to him, but I sort of kind of cried off for the moment, so to speak. And then about 10 minutes later, whilst in the middle of another sentence, I turned around to the guy. I said, for example, now you can look at your foot right there and it is stuck solidly. And his foot was stuck at that point.
Right.
Now, I'm absolutely sure, I can't possibly know, because you don't get to rerun reality. You see what I mean? It's like, well, that's what happened. I believe if I'd have taken him during his challenge, I would not have got the result. Right? So.
Yeah.
Because he was too set. He's too set in one position to want to move to another. I'm aware that my job as a hypnotist is to get somebody to, let's say, take up a different psychological position from the one that they're in. Now, somebody might show up already open to being moved to another psychological position, in which case we can go straight there. But when they're set not to be, I have to loosen that set somehow. I can't just meet that as a challenge. And meeting it as a challenge, there's a simple rule: push on people and they push back. Now, this is my belief. The only, the most ballsy individual I've seen with this is my friend James Brown.
Yeah.
Who I've seen him do this on more than one occasion, where he said, is there anyone in the audience who is absolutely sure that they cannot be hypnotized? Is absolutely, you completely, I definitely cannot be hypnotized. And he'll pick that person to demo with.
Wow.
Right? Now, the thing that James is doing is the classic confidence trick. So all he has to do is hold his reality so strongly that they shatter with theirs. Now, it works enough times. It doesn't work every time. There'll be times when it doesn't work. But I know James's personal philosophy, which is he just shrugs. He doesn't care. So because he's not afraid of losing, he can really, really go all out. I suspect Justin Trance is the same. He's not afraid of losing, so he's willing to boldly venture.
Yeah.
I recall an occasion in Australia when I was running a workshop, and you may have heard this story, but I was doing a name amnesia on this guy, with this guy. And I got to the sort of the payoff point, and I said, so you can look at me, you can try and say their name, fine, it's just gone now. Look at me, try to say it's gone. And he looked me straight in the eye and said, Bob. And I didn't miss a beat. I said, that's right, you can try. That's it, try. And then he couldn't say his name. And afterwards, I said to him, I said, I just want to check in. You know, when we were doing the name amnesia, you know, you said your name right. He said, I thought I did, but you made me doubt myself. Hmm. So, you know, the truth is yes, you can do challenge hypnosis, but you've got to be able to run your inner game so strongly in that moment. Right. This is where the inner craft becomes most powerful. If you waver on the inside, it's definitely lost. If you hold your position on the inside, it isn't even definitely won, but it massively increases the chances that it is won.
This is where I wonder about you and Jeffrey Stevens and your differences in philosophy. That sounds very similar. So there's some things you've said that do sound similar, and I'm curious to extract the differences. I asked him about visual hallucinations because he was going on and yeah, I can get anything out of anyone. And he talked a big talk, and he was saying, you know, Greg, do you have the intent? when you are sitting there with someone and you want them to be able to see a dog that's not actually there, are you actually seeing it? And are you believing in your core that they're going to be able to see it? Mm. Now, I'm a trained actor. I mean, maybe there is some, there probably was a little self-doubt about it that I had. I will say, yeah, when I was testing this stuff out, specifically his methodology and going through the processes and all this stuff, I wasn't fully there. But also, I did enough experimenting with traditional, do the pre-talk, the convincer, the get into all the, you know, the suggestibility test to know that, huh, sometimes I'd get amnesia, sometimes I wouldn't, sometimes I'd go all the way. I mean, he strongly believed in intent. What do you believe it takes to get somebody to actually experience any phenomena you want them to experience?
I do not believe I can get anyone to experience any phenomena that I want them to experience. I do believe that I can get a lot of people to experience a lot of things, and I'm always curious as to what. And the most important thing is to be completely okay with whatever happens. What undermines a lot of people is an attachment to a particular outcome. Like they think of something even like a hand stick. Oh my God, you know, but what if it doesn't work?
Yeah.
And the fact they're even asking the question says a lot about their internal reality and all the fears they've got running. And I'm not knocking anyone for coming from that place, because I used to be there myself. So the sort of fearlessness, intent, it's absolutely true. You know, what Jeff is saying is absolutely true. Although I do know that when he did his London workshop, I opened up his London workshop and did the phenomena work, because he said that he didn't do phenomena work.
Interesting. Right?
That's what he said to me. He said, do you want to come and open up the weekend, do a bunch of phenomena stuff for people? Because I don't really do that kind of thing. And I said, yeah, sure, I'll come along and I'll do it. And I have an interesting story from that, actually, which I keep meaning to tell in the Online Deep Apprenticeship, but I haven't yet. I was talking about visual hallucination, and I was talking about another time when I'd got a visual hallucination with somebody. And there was a girl there, I think she's about 19, 20, and she'd come in to visit her brother, because her brother was in London for this workshop, and she was in London the rest of the time. So she's just kind of ducked into the back of the workshop. She had no interest in hypnosis, didn't know anything about hypnosis really. So she was a sort of an outsider, and she was sat there just listening to me closing off. And I was telling a story about hallucination. And as I told the story, I said to this person, what color, size, and breed is that dog there? And I fully did it, and I fully pointed. And I noticed as I pointed that this girl, her eyes went like saucers and her mouth dropped open, right? I wasn't even talking to her. I was just talking to the audience as a whole.
Yeah.
Right. Her eyes went like saucers and her mouth dropped open. And I saw it, and I turned and I said, and what's just happened for you? Right. And she went, my God, there's a dog. Right.
Yeah.
I wasn't even trying to do anything. I just kind of went into, I was acting as if, like, I was reenacting a time before when I'd done it. You know, and she obviously bought in enough to the fact that I was a hypnotist. And she obviously had enough kind of latent capacity to hallucinate readily. Nobody else in the room, by the way, just her. It's like 20 people there, maybe more. Right. So just her. Now, if it was something I'd done specifically, if it was just about what I'd done, everyone in the room would have seen the dog, right? But only she saw the dog. Now, she was not accustomed to seeing dogs randomly. So if it was just about her and she randomly hallucinated, she would be randomly hallucinating the rest of the time or would have found nothing surprising about the situation. But there was an interaction between what I did then and there in that occasion and what she brought. And between the two of us, we created for her a dog hallucination, albeit unintentionally. Right? So there's always two sides, and hypnosis is always a co-creation like this between you and the other person. Whether it's knowingly a co-creation or not, it's still a co-creation. I cannot control anybody to hallucinate anything. All I can ever do is set the conditions to make it as likely as I can possibly make it, according to my understanding of things, and allow it to occur or not. And it's, you know, it's going to go one way or another. But yeah, you know, I too wanted that point where I used to want mind control. That's when I first got into hypnosis. It's like, that's what I want. I want mind control. But I kind of like, the irony is, it's like the more you, I think the more you get away from control and start looking towards influence and freeing yourself to really create with other human beings, with their neurology, with their psychology, with their belief systems, the more you let go of control, the more your influence increases and the more likely you are to get the outcomes that you want.
Yeah.
Weirdly.
Yeah. I wonder, I mean, I guess this is just as somebody that is drawn to the magic or something supernatural. I remember having a discussion with one of my uncles, and he was sort of posing some skepticism towards hypnosis. And I was like, yeah, but think about what great lawyers are doing in court. Think about what politicians are doing. That is a form of hypnosis. And then he immediately, this is the lawyer in him, well, that's, yeah, but that's just, that's a metaphor. You're talking about putting people's hands, sticking people's hands to the walls versus actually having influence and charisma and all that stuff. And that always jarred me in the sense of being like, huh, yeah. Is there a piece, a unknowable ingredient between a strong lawyer influencing a jury versus a lawyer stepping in front of a jury and speaking in a hypnotic language pattern and getting all of them to zone out right there? What is that? That I don't know. I guess it's like an elixir of some sort, that piece that turns crap into gold, the alchemizing. Right. Is that really a thing? Or in your view, is it really? No, hypnosis and influence can be the same thing. There doesn't need to be like a quote unquote magic piece to it.
I like hypnosis and influence, as far as I'm concerned, are the same thing.
That's what it sounds like.
I mean, you know, if somebody, you're influencing somebody to experience their hand stuck to a table, you're influencing them to have an emotion. You know, you're influencing somebody. It's just influence. It's understanding the nature of influence. Like did you say it was your uncle that came up with this?
Yeah.
Objection?
Yeah.
His objection is fallacious, I'm going to say. And here's why. You know, good. If you look at one of my favorite books is by the lawyer, Jerry Spence, who was said to have never lost a case.
Yes.
I love his book, How to Argue and Win Every Time. His book, How to Argue and Win Every Time, has got nothing to do with logical arguments. Got nothing to do with beating anybody's arguments. It's to do with how you evoke emotional states in people. You know, so like if you evoke an experience of sympathy in somebody, that's not any different from evoking an experience of a stuck hand. It isn't. It's just exactly the same. Now, it might be that this is the argument I make between formal hypnosis and conversational hypnosis. In conversational hypnosis or influence, suggestion work, whatever, you can create any effect that is congruent with the frame, i.e. what people believe are happening. So inside of the frame of a normal conversation, shifts in emotion are congruent with that. So they won't flag anything. Nobody will think that's too weird. If you're going to do something which is outside of the realm of everyday reality, you're going to invoke a shift or evoke a shift that's outside of the realm of everyday reality, you have to create this big because. You have to say, this is possible because something unusual is happening.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So, and it's the belief in what's unusual. So if you go back to the example of the accidental dog hallucination with the girl, if I'd have said that I was a comedian, she'd have come in believing I was a comedian instead of believing I was a hypnotist, and I'd done the same thing. The only effect would be she'd have been bewildered, thinking, well, this isn't very funny.
Yeah.
Right? So she needed a big because. She bought in enough to the idea of hypnosis and the fact that I was a hypnotist to allow her mind to go in a particular direction unchallenged and to create the result that she created. I genuinely myself, I see no difference between influence and hypnosis. Now, I also want to be clear that when you move somebody's mind, it can change things in their physiology and does change things in their physiology. That's how placebo works. You know, the ideomotor response, the idea of the ideomotor response, that doesn't come from hypnosis. Mm. That comes from a guy who was trying to explain how seances and Ouija boards worked.
Yeah.
And then it was co-opted into hypnosis. But it's that recognition, the Ouija board phenomenon is an accepted phenomenon. And the scientific explanation is the ideomotor response. So all that is people believing the glass is going to move and expecting the glass to move, and then they got their fingers on it, and it starts to move, and they follow the movement. You know, minds manifest through physiology. You lead someone's mind to a different place, the physiology changes. A hand stick is just a physiological change. If somebody is listening, my daughter was crying her eyes out yesterday at a TV show because some character that she loved got killed. Right? Those tears were real. That was a real physiological response because the TV show makers have pulled her into a different reality.
Do you think then, had this in a recent guest of my show, very much dismissed hypnosis as just placebo effect. What would you say if someone was like, yeah, it's all just placebo?
No. They got it the wrong way around. Placebo is hypnosis. It's not that hypnosis is placebo.
That's what I think.
Well, I mean, you know, you could argue and say that's just a little semantic twist. But what placebo is it's a communication, right? It's not the fact that they're handed a sugar pill and they swallow it. It's what they are told that it means, right?
Mm.
That's the thing that counts, not the pill. The pill might be a ritual act that feeds into the communication, but it's what they are told it means. This pill is medicine. That's a complex equivalence. Pill is medicine in NLP terms, right? It's the handing over a placebo is the engaging of a belief system, right? This is hypnosis. This is exactly how hypnosis works. So it's true to say that hypnosis is placebo or placebo is hypnosis, or they are both examples of mind-body influence and how we can influence the mind and the mind in turn influences the body.
Yeah.
So yeah, you know, they are the same, but like that doesn't really say much to go, well, it's just placebo. Well, what's placebo then? Isn't placebo magnificent? Isn't placebo magical?
I think it is. Yeah. Right.
You know, so it's like, well, you know, hell yes, it is. Placebo is hypnosis. So it seems crazy to dismiss it like that.
Yeah.
Instead of go, well, what's possible now that we know this, now that we know that how people experience things, how people perceive things changes what's happening for them physiologically. You know, how cool is that?
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess, you know, to further deconstruct the argument that this person was making, he's saying that, well, none of the change is going to work unless at some unconscious level they are going to expect that it and they want it to change enough. That's why hypnosis isn't powerful, all powerful. You can call it whatever you want, but it's just a placebo that they really, some level, they need to work for some reason. And he was saying that's right. How stage hypnosis work too and all that stuff. What do you think about that?
I think there's some interesting, who was it? Was it Ernest Rossi? I think Ernest Rossi was doing some research and doing some work with people who were, they were in late stages in cancer. And it was pretty much like, well, you know, it's over for you now. It's just palliative care. And of course, most of these people went on to die, but some of them they had remissions.
Hmm.
Now, the point of this story is not that it's much of a story, but the point is not that they had remissions after having hypnosis from Rossi. Maybe they'd have had them anyway. The thing that Rossi noted is some of these people he went on who'd had remissions, he went on to work with hypnotically later on, and they were considerably worse hypnotic subjects when they were no longer motivated by avoiding death.
Mm.
So I think this was Rossi. This is a long time I'm thinking back to when I read this study. But the point was, is that motivation appears to make a difference in terms of quote unquote hypnotizability.
Yes.
So I do think that it is, there is a sense of, this is why, like in my work, I emphasize things like buy-in, getting buy-in. It's really important. If somebody doesn't buy in for what you're offering, then, you know, there's no magic that avoids their utter disbelief or their utter rejection of what you're going to do. They won't even engage if they're going to reject, you know, what they're going to do, what you're going to do. It didn't make any sense what I just said there, but, you know, that's
right.
But my point is you've got, you know, you've got to get the buy-in. And there, once you get the buy-in, there is a degree of expectancy. This is a huge thing that I use in change work all the time. Part of my future pacing that I do at the end of a change work session, it's all about setting expectancy.
Mm.
You know, and I'm implying things are going to be different. I like to imply there's going to be difference and deliberately not specify the difference. Because if I specify the difference, it's easy to be made wrong. If I just have them searching for some unspecified difference, they're going to rule all sorts of things in, which feeds back into the system and increases. It's a hypnotic loop process, so increases belief. The hypnosis isn't over just because they leave the office, so to speak. I want to set feedback loops that feed forward into their lives. So I think there's a lot to it. But this is the danger of going, yes, but that's just. You know, the explanation that says, yes, but that's just placebo, that's just expectancy. So what? It's not just. It's the placebo and expectancy are related phenomena. Expectancy is something that we utilize. You know, it's like saying hypnosis is just psychology. Well, if that was true, then it doesn't diminish hypnosis one bit.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. The word just does. That's a hypnotic word, ironically. If somebody says hypnosis is just placebo, it's a different statement from saying hypnosis is placebo. Right? Those are two different statements because they leave the mind in different ways, right? Just is a magic hypnotic diminishing word.
Yes.
Right? It's a play all the time. Every single word is hypnotic.
If you enjoyed this episode of Open Loops with Greg Bornstein, Conversations That Bend, please make sure to subscribe at Apple Podcasts and rate the show, leave a review, even a sentence will help. I want to thank James again for a stunningly illuminating dialogue. Check out tripnosis.com, that's tripnosis.com, as well as hypnosiswithouttrance.com. And I'm gonna just sit here and put the pieces of my brain back together. That's what this guy does. He makes me so much more excited about what hypnosis could be rather than what everybody else has told us it is. That's what I love. Challenges my beliefs constantly. And in part three, you get to hear if James has ever used hypnosis to get out of a parking ticket. It's coming up soon. Take care, everybody.